In 1914, Arnold Rushforth wrote a letter to his wife, telling her all about a naval engagement he had fought in. "It is with great thankfulness that I am able to inform you that all is well. I am not injured in any way after our naval engagement, which took place off the Brazilian coast on September the 16th. I do not feel inclined to relate to you the details of our engagement, so let it suffice to say that it was a ding-dong struggle as to who had to go under." This curious description of a battle was a naval battle like no other, a battle where two ocean liners fought in open battle until only one could be left floating. This is the tale of the Great Ocean Liner Duel of 1914. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Jammy History Podcast, the show that aims to spread the truth about the history you didn't know. I am your host, Jamie, and today we will be exploring the worst cruise liners to be on, the RMS Carmania and the SMS Cap Trafalgar. Prepare for a tale of war, seas, and a disguise that really didn't work out. But first, I'd just like to say thank you so much for everyone that listened to the first episode of Season 2 and for giving such nice feedback on it. It is greatly appreciated to hear how much you enjoyed it. And if you enjoy this episode, then do let me know as well. Maybe we need all cruiser liners to battle against each other, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's delve into the deep Atlantic waters of this tale. At the dawn of the 20th century, there was still this honourable notion that dominated the minds of admirals and captains that had to be broken before the Carmenara and Cap Trafalgar could ever come to fight each other. And this was the concept of cruiser rules. See, in a war, there are more than just military vessels that could be found crossing the Atlantic. Why let a war stop the economy from flourishing, or people travelling to different countries on passenger vessels? You can't just have battleships travelling around, sinking ships just because they wanted to. That would be ridiculous. But if a country was buying war material, then you also couldn't just let them transport it without consequence. So that is where a set of rules had to be established to ensure that merchants transporting war material were stopped, but without shooting civilians in the process. And that is where cruiser rules come into play. The basic idea was that any military vessel had the right to engage merchant vessels if they were believed to be transporting war material. The catch was that the military vessel had to first signal that it was going to attack. They would sail up aggressively signalling to the merchant vessel that they were to be boarded, and that if they ignored the message, then they would be fired upon. Once boarded, the merchant vessel could be taken back to the nearest port, along with the crew and cargo that would now have to be cared for by the military ship. These rules were enough to keep a peaceful relationship between military and merchant vessels since the 17th century. On the whole, both parties could be satisfied by the arrangement. The merchants, because they would be looked after whilst under captivity, and they could resume business afterwards, and the military, because they could deny the enemy war material without having to fire a shot. It was even better for them if they could catch a group of merchant ships at the same time, as one single military ship could take multiple merchants prisoner. But there was just one small problem with this system, and that was submarines. Submarines had made a rather underwhelming debut on the world, with the first one undergoing combat during the American Civil War. The Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley became the first submarine in history to successfully sink an enemy vessel, but it also became the first submarine to be sunk during combat. Both of these records were broken in the same engagement. But how is that possible? Well, early submarines didn't have torpedoes we would associate with them nowadays, and instead they had to resort to what I could only describe as explosive jousting. Take a long metal stick and attach a barrel of gunpowder onto the end of it, then just whack the enemy vessel until the barrel explodes and boom, explosive jousting. But when the Hunley did this, the pressure caused by the shockwave killed all the crew on board instantly, so clearly submarines had a long way to go before they could be utilised more openly. But by 1914, submarines had not only mastered the art of resisting shockwaves, but had introduced torpedoes into their arsenal. Now a submarine could bypass enemy vessels and appear right next to merchant ships. This caused a mini crisis in faith as people began to ask the fatal question, do cruiser rules apply to this situation? The problem is that if submarines are allowed to threaten enemy shipping into surrender, then the task of protecting your merchants suddenly becomes infinitely worse. But if they aren't allowed to, then the submarines could just as easily sink whatever vessels came into their path and carry on. The general consensus among the Entente Admiralty, in particular, was that as submarines weren't real cruisers, there was no obligation for merchant vessels to surrender to them. And so begins this idea of unrestricted submarine warfare, where submarines could sink whoever they wanted, whenever they wanted. Now it had fallen to the navies of the Entente to devise ways of protecting their merchant vessels. A couple of ideas were introduced to help combat German submarines that were hammering the Entente shipping throughout the war. Depth charges to launch lethal shockwaves at submarines, convoys to keep the merchant vessels together so the defence could be concentrated, and when military planes become a proper thing, scout planes to spot submarines before they could strike. But today, this episode revolves around a rather novel suggestion, one that would protect the convoys that the Navy could not spare the ships to escort, and that was the idea of Q-ships. Q-ships were just like any merchant vessel, completely identical except for in one capacity, and that was that these merchants would be armed. The simple idea was that if you had a merchant ship sailing around, it would look like an easy target for submarines, who only had to surface and point their torpedoes at the vessel, and then it would surrender, in line with the cruiser rules. But when that submarine surfaced, the ship could quickly unload its arsenal of weapons that were hidden on board and then fire at the submarine, sinking it now that it had exposed itself. And when I say weapons, I don't just mean a couple of machine guns. I mean full-on artillery guns that could blow a hole through a submarine if they hit it just right. Now this sounds like a clever idea, but there were problems with this that the Entente quickly discovered when they applied this against the Germans. The main problem was that once you start arming merchants, they no longer can be classed as defenseless, which means that cruiser rules no longer apply to them. Furthermore, if you start using this trick, then that creates a sense of paranoia from your enemy. With every ship, they would have to ask themselves, are these guys for real, or are they just pretending? Now, if you're a U-boat captain, what is the easiest way to answer that question without putting yourself at risk? If you answered by suggesting that you should just sink every merchant ship before it could potentially fire back, then congratulations, you've just become a German submarine commander. If every ship was not a potential threat, then you couldn't even rely on the cruiser rules to keep you safe, so why bother? And so unrestricted submarine warfare began. To be fair, the idea of Q-ships wasn't a new concept. In the 1670s, the British ship HMS Kingfisher would masquerade as a merchant vessel to lure in pirates, before unleashing a full salvo of cannon fire on the unsuspecting vessel. But that was in an age when cruiser rules were not even a concept, and merchant vessels could be targeted more during times of war. Now, the code of conduct had been disregarded. There was no point in the Germans obeying it themselves. But the ball was now in the German court. Sure, they could ramp up submarine warfare, but perhaps there was another way to turn this idea of Q-ships against the Entente. What if you could make the merchants suspicious of any new ship that joined that convoy? What if you broke the idea of the Q-ships serving as hidden protectors? What if you made your own Q-ship designed to attack merchants? That's right, the Germans sought to Uno reverse the system on the Entente by creating their own series of Q-ships. These Q-ships would join merchant convoys and, during the night, unpack their own arsenal of weapons and sink nearby vessels. If possible, they could then hide the weapons again and continue pretending to be an innocent member of the convoy reeling from the travesty that happened the night before. It was a bold plan, But fortunately for them, they had the perfect candidate to trial this out with, the SMS Cap Trafalgar. The SMS Cap Trafalgar was a relatively new ocean liner that was 187 metres long and could carry nearly 1,600 passengers. It also came complete with a swimming pool and a cafe and a greenhouse, while her first class halls and stairways were built of beautiful gold filigree, and her staterooms were furnished in the highest fashion of the period. She was, in a word, magnificent. And she had only been on her maiden voyage in April of 1914. This meant that when the war was declared in August of that year, she was still in port at Buenos Aires, waiting for her next passengers to arrive. This meant that they didn't even have to worry about getting her to the Atlantic. So the German Navy bought her at the very start of the war and began making preparations to transport weapons and a new crew for the vessel. But some of you may be wondering, why on earth would you buy an ocean liner to start out with? The Titanic would not have been anyone's first choice for a battleship, right? Well, there was something about the Cap Trafalgar that made it very appealing. It looked like some noteworthy British ocean liners. It had a strong resemblance to one RMS Carmania, a slightly older British ocean liner that had launched in 1905. This meant that at a glance, the Cap Trafalgar could pass as a British ship easily, allowing it to join the convoys without arousing much suspicion. Plus, it was likely that the Carmania had already been bought by the Royal Navy to use as a troop transport, so if it randomly showed up to a convoy, no one would have been confused to see it. Now, the Germans were not planning to pretend to be the Carmania, but they did use it as a basis for what a British merchant vessel should look like, right down to what paint it would use to cover itself in. It was pretty much the perfect cover story. And so they moved the SMS Cap Trafalgar to Trindade, where the German ship SMS Eber was waiting to transfer two 4.1-inch guns and six 1-powder pom-poms onto their brand new Q ship. Just to clarify, pom-poms are like the little guns that they use as anti-air cans, and they just got the name because that's the sound they make when they fire. I just find it funny. But once the preparations had been completed, it can now sail off into the Atlantic under the command of Julius Wirth and began raiding against any and all Allied shipping it could find. And so it set sail, looking for its first victim. Sadly, the German crew actually had no idea where to find a convoy and ended up having to return back to Trindade for refueling. So it was hardly the grand maiden voyage they were hoping for, but it was still early days. They could just try again another day. They would eventually have to find something. And on the 14th of September, they could finally put this to the test. And before anyone mentions it, yes, I know that Arnold Rushforth said this happened on the 16th of September, but trust me, he got his dates mixed up. The crew were looking out and they could see columns of smoke rising next to the island. Finally, a merchant ship has stumbled right into their trap. They scrambled to their stations and sailed after it in hot pursuit. There was a sense of excitement in the air as they could finally put their design to the ultimate test. It was time to sink a merchant vessel. After a few hours of just chasing this ship around the island, they caught up with it and turned the corner to see... Wait. Is that the SMS Cap Trafalgar? You could almost imagine the look of confusion in all their faces. Here they were sailing on the SMS Cap Trafalgar, looking directly at a ship that was also the SMS Cap Trafalgar. The crew on board just stood there, blinking and not moving as they processed what they were seeing. After some confused signalling, the crew were able to deduce what had happened. This ship was not the SMS Cap Trafalgar. It was the real RMS Carmania, commanded by Captain Noel Grant, loaded with weapons to fight against submarines. What they hadn't realised was that the RMS Carmania had been bought by the Royal Navy and it had been turned into a Q-ship, fully decked out with all the weapons that they could need. And now here it was, looking right at its doppelganger. Of all the ships they had to run into, of course it would be the one that they were themselves impersonating. Now I'd quickly like to clarify something, because some people give off the wrong impression when presenting this moment. If you Google this story, there are a couple of artistic paintings that show two very different looking cruise ships fighting each other. These images are built on the misunderstanding that the Germans had made their ship look identical to the British Carmania, and that the British had made their ship look like the SMS Cap Trafalgar. But in reality, both ships did look the same because they were given the same grey paint that the British merchant ships were supposed to have during wartime. So these ships didn't look like they used to in times of peace. Picture the Titanic, but all of it is grey, and that's what both of these ships looked like. But anyway, back to it. The Germans and British had found themselves in a very awkward situation, but now that they'd found each other, they couldn't just ignore it. The RMS Carmania could now let the rest of the British fleet know what the Germans had been planning, and put a stop to their intentions of sneaking into convoys. So the Cap Trafalgar had to sink the original ship that it was impersonating, before the secret could be exposed. Likewise, the RMS Carmania had to sink this doppelganger before it could cause any damage to the rest of the merchant navy. Not only that, but the crew on both ships were spoiling for a fight. Why? Well, this was the first exciting thing to happen to them since the war began. Who knows when they'd get another opportunity like this again? And so both ships prepared for a battle like no other. A battle between two ocean liners. This would be the Great Ocean Liner Duel of 1914. And so the battle was on. Both captains looked at each other and understood the situation well enough. In order for this to work, they would need plenty of space first to manoeuvre and use their guns effectively. And so, like the duels of old, both boats turned away from each other and began sailing away until one of them would turn and unleash the first salvo. And those first shots came from the British ship Carmania. Captain Grant had observed his German counterpart and realised that he greatly outgunned his adversary with his impressive arsenal of 8 Q4 4.7-inch Mark V naval guns. Unfortunately for Grant, this first shot was a miscalculation, as the Cap Trafalgar weaved in between the incoming salvo and unleashed a devastating volley in return. Both ships began sailing towards each other, and, like it was a Napoleonic battle, fired volley after volley at their opposing ship. The fighting was intense, as highlighted in Arnold Rushforth's account of the battle. As the saying was at the time, we gave the Germans hell. Our gunners fought up to the old reputation of the bulldog breed. Every man fought with never-tiring energy, and their marksmanship was splendid. They rattled the shells in one after the other, and got home about 4 shells to the Germans' 1. Both ships were taking a beating. Neither of them were designed for this kind of battle, and yet here they were. And it was in that moment that some of the German sailors realised something. They were facing a ship that wasn't designed for all-out warfare. Now, while the cannons were doing well, they just didn't have enough to keep up with the Carmania's rate of fire. But what the Carmania had in weaponry, it lacked in durability. The Cap Trafalgar had weapons that would normally never work against proper naval vessels. But they could work against a repurposed ocean liner. And so the German crews ran over to the pom-poms that I love so much. These things were only intended to be used against planes, but they were going to be used against the Carmania. They unleashed a devastating volley with these guns on the Carmania that ripped holes right through the side of the ship and began to set it alight. At this moment, it looked like the Carmania had no choice but to flee the battle before they were completely destroyed. Captain Grant agreed with this view and began to take the Carmania out of the engagement. As it sailed away, the two rear cannons began firing at the captured Trafalgar to cover the retreat until one of the shells ripped through the German waterline and caused the ship to start tipping to one side from all the flooding. At this point, any sensible commander would probably look at the situation and call it a draw before things got out of hand. These were more than just mere scratches. They were on fire, taking on water heavily, tipping to one side. But to them, it was all just a flesh wound. Because remember when I said how both crews wanted to fight, as it could be their one exciting act throughout the war, their one chance of glory? The problem was not only did the captain and crew want to keep on fighting. They looked at their own ships, one on fire, the other one already sinking, and went, yeah, we could still win this. And so the battle continued. The Carmania turned around once more and began charging towards the captured Trafalgar yet again. But suddenly, a third ship entered the battlefield. This part is often overlooked when discussing the battle, but I just had to mention it. See, when the Germans commandeered the captured Trafalgar, they left behind the original captain from when it was just a civilian vessel. This man was Captain Langerhans. And he was furious. The captured Trafalgar was his pride and joy, and there he was, stood on some random island in the middle of nowhere, watching it get blown to pieces in its very first battle. Wanting to just save what was left of his ship, he assembled the rest of his civilian crew onto a small civilian vessel they'd found, strapped on the only weapon he could find, which was an 18th century bronze mortar that had been left on the island, and sailed right onto the battle. There, his crew fired the mortar at the Carmania and did anything they could just to disrupt the battle or at least force the British to retreat. They fired shells, they fired guns. I wouldn't be surprised if they started throwing spoons at the Carmania in the hopes that one of them would breach the deck. But all they did was prove to be a minor inconvenience, and basically after one shot the mortar gave in, and Langerhans could do nothing but watch the ships sail towards each other for one final broadside. By the end of this clash, both ships were on fire, their water lines broken, and they were both leaning to one side. To an onlooker, it would be hard to tell at first which one was even still operational. But within minutes, it was clear that the captured Trafalgar was going down and the crew began abandoning ship. The Carmania, despite all its damages, was still afloat. But barely. Arnold Rushforth clearly describes the absolute state the ship was now in. Our ship, however, looks a sorry sight, for it is almost full of shell holes and the captain's bridge and officers' quarters were completely burned out. Though the enemy fought well, our boys fought better, and they deserve great praise for the victory over the captured Trafalgar. The Carmania turned and began to leave the battle, because they couldn't even keep the ship afloat long enough for the return journey, let alone to stay and rescue survivors from the enemy ship. Captain Grant sailed off, hoping to find another British ship that could tow it back to port for urgent repairs. When they reached another British ship, it was a wonder the ship could even still float, and it was definitely on its last legs. Chances are, if it had been forced to sail for about one more day, the Carmania would also have succumbed to its damages and been left at the bottom of the sea. She was taken to Pernambuco for urgent repairs, before being repaired fully at Gibraltar and allowed to go back out for active service. But as for the captured Trafalgar, they had to hope that rescue reached them in time before the ship was gone for good, and time was ticking. Both sides had sent alerts out to their respective navies that there was a fight going on, and that they should all show up to help. And a few hours after the Carmania left, a ship arrived to the site of the captured Trafalgar on death's door. But fortunately, it was a German ship. It was the armed merchant ship SS Kronprinz Wilhelm. Now the crew could get rescued and return home safely. And now they are leaving. They are leaving! That's right. The captain of the SS Kronprinz Wilhelm looked at the situation. and thought that the carcass of Cap Trafalgar was the bait for a clever ambush. So despite probably insisting that he would have loved to have helped, the ship turned away and sailed off, leaving their comrades to their fate. All hope appeared lost until a collier ship carrying coal, known as the Eleanor Vermin, stumbled onto the scene and rescued the German crew before it was too late and took them to Argentina. Following this engagement, the Carmania would be utilised as a troop transport for the remainder of the war, before being allowed to return to civilian life, where she would remain in service until 1931. And fortunately for all the crew on board, it would never again be flown into an active combat situation like it had against the Cap Trafalgar. And with that, our story comes to an end. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have enjoyed it. If you have, then be sure to rate, follow, and share the podcast. I would greatly appreciate it. And let me know what you think about this tale. Should we go back to strapping cannons onto cruise ships and making them fight Napoleonic-styled battles? I'm on board with the concept personally. Also, if you have enjoyed, then consider donating to my Patreon to keep the lights on and the ship engines running. You can join the Jammy Army, just like the wonderful Lara, Hannah, Historic Hills, and my very own dad have. For the next episode, we have a variety of options that could be thrown your way, so stay tuned on all my socials for updates about what you'll be hearing next. Will it be one of the many collaborations that I have in the works? Will it be the next solo episode about the Chinese Brother of Jesus? Who knows? But whatever the next tale will be, I hope you will be joining me for it. Until that moment, take care and see you next time.